Let's turn to that passage again, Ecclesiastes 4, verses 4 to 16. Now, if when we die, we leave behind everything we've worked for, and we leave the world exactly as we came into it, with nothing, then all striving after wealth, all striving after eminence and status are completely pointless. That's the message of Ecclesiastes. So I hope we've all understood that and have begun to adjust our lives and our lifestyles in the light of that. Now, another point that Ecclesiastes makes is that striving for wealth and eminence and status, not only pointless, because we leave it all behind when we die, it also means that we actually miss out on a lot of the really good things in life, which have nothing to do with wealth or power or status. And one of those really good things in life, which have nothing to do with power or status or wealth, is relationships, community, friendship. Our society is becoming increasingly isolated and individualistic. One of the reasons for the housing crisis is because so many houses are inhabited by just one person. Houses used to be inhabited by an average of, say, 3.2 people or something like that. But now, increasingly, houses have simply one person living in them. And as the church has declined, so, at the same time, have all community organisations, which traditionally were provided by the church or staffed by the church. They're all in decline. And even non-church community organisations are in decline. Have you noticed how many pubs are closing in Kendal? People just stay at home now and look at screens. That's all they do when they're not at work, and they're usually looking at screens when they're at work as well. Even meals as social occasions are in decline. Entertaining friends in the home is in decline. Even family meals are in decline. People don't eat together as families as much as they used to. The friendly corner shop has been replaced by the supermarket. I remember when I was a lad, a small boy, my mother had an old bag which she kept exclusively for potatoes, which in those days were sold individually and dirty. That's why she had a special bag for the potato. And every now and again she would send me to Mitchell's, which was our corner shop, to get a stone of potato. And when I arrived at the corner shop, there would invariably be at least half a dozen ladies in the shop. And I would stand there with my bag for ages, for what seemed like hours sometimes, listening to the conversation. And it became quite clear to me that most of the ladies didn't actually want to buy anything. After a long conversation, the lady would say, "Oh, I'll have a Brillo pad, please." And they were there really just to talk, to connect. Where do people go nowadays to meet people? Where do people go nowadays just to connect, just to talk, if they're not church goers? And alongside this collapse in community, at the same time, there's been an enormous rise in people seeking therapy and counselling, basically because they're lonely. Increasingly, people are trying to do life by themselves. And the Bible says, and it's one of the first things that God says in the Bible, that it's not good. He actually says that. It is not good for a man or a woman, if it had just been the woman and not the man in the Garden of Eden, He'd have said the same thing about women as well. It is not good for a man or a woman to be alone. We were made for community. We were made for friendship. And according to the Bible, this is a reflection of the nature of God Himself. And this is an insight which is absolutely unique to biblical Christianity. You won't find it anywhere else but biblical Christianity. According to the Bible, God has never been lonely. According to the Bible, God cannot be lonely. Within the being of the one God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, there has always been love, there has always been community, there has always been fellowship. God is love. That is His eternal nature. He has always loved, and He has always been loved. There has therefore always been more than one person in the Godhead. If you don't believe in the Trinity, in other words, if you're a Jehovah's Witness, or if you're a Muslim, or a Jew, actually, if you don't believe in the Trinity, you're saying that love is not essential to the nature of God. There was a time before He created human beings when He didn't love. There was nobody to love but Himself. And loving yourself isn't love. Love is loving somebody else. So if you don't believe in the Trinity, there was a time when God wasn't love. And God could therefore be God without love. Love is not essential to the nature of God. In fact, what is essential to the nature of God, if you don't believe in the Trinity, is power. Bare power. Well, power is essential to the nature of God, but according to the Bible, love is essential to the nature of God as well. He has always loved. He has always been loved. He has never been solitary. He has never been lonely. And the Bible says that God made us in His image and likeness. In other words, amongst other things, He made us to love and to be loved. That's why He said it is not good for a man or a woman to be alone. When God said that, Adam had creation below him, he had God above him, but he had no one alongside him. And one solution to that problem, of course, was marriage. In fact, a very, very important solution to that problem was marriage. But not all of us are married. And we live quite a good proportion of our lives before we get married. And many of us lose our married partner and have many years of life to live after that. And some of us do not get married at all. So marriage isn't the only solution to human aloneness. We were meant, whether we're married or unmarried, for community, for friendship, for relationship. And some Christians will say, well, I don't need any friends, God is with me. Or I can cope quite well just having Jesus. Well, Adam had a perfect relationship with God. Far better relationship with God than you have at the moment. And yet God said it was still not good for him to be alone. There was still something missing. Even though he had a perfect relationship with God, there was still something, or someone, perhaps we should say, missing. He needed another human being. With him, alongside him. God above him, creation below him, another human being with him. Now, the teacher in Ecclesiastes values friendship very highly, and in verses 9 to 12 of this chapter 4, we have a lovely little poem about the value of companionship and the folly of trying to face life alone. Verses 9 to 12, a poem about the advantages of partnership over independence. Look at it, verse 9. Two are better than one. Two are better than one. Now that's often applied to marriage. But this passage is not primarily about marriage. It's often preached on at marriage services, and that's fine, but it is not primarily about marriage. It ends by saying a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So this isn't a marriage. You don't have three people in a marriage. We all know what Princess Diana had to say about that. It doesn't work. So this isn't primarily about marriage. Yes, I know the standard wedding address is the man and the woman and God. That's the threefold cord. And that's nice, but it's not what the passage is actually about. The passage is about human companionship. Two are better than one, he says, and three are even better. Two people, he says, get more done. Two are better than one, verse 9, because they have a good return for their work. Two people get more done. They accomplish more. Some people want to do everything themselves. Maybe they don't trust anybody to do as good a job as they think they can do. So they like to do it themselves. They actually think they're better at what they do than other people. So they don't want any help. They'd rather do it themselves. Maybe they don't want to share the praise or the recognition with anybody else. And if you have somebody with you, working with you, you have to consult their interests, their convenience, their opinions. You have to adjust to their style or their pace. And you have to share the glory, the praise and the recognition with them. So people will often say, well, I don't need any help. I'd rather just do it myself, thank you very much. The teacher says, you do need help. We all need help. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. And the picture actually here in this poem is a picture of travel. The three examples, verses 10, 11 and 12, are all taken from travel. If you have a travelling companion, it's better. Verse 10, if one falls down, his friend can help him up. If you're travelling, you may well fall. There have been a number of people who have fallen in this congregation just on the streets of Kendal, which are notoriously not well put together. But if you were travelling on the roads in those days, you were even more likely to fall. So if you're travelling, it's good to have somebody with you, says the teacher. Because if you fall, someone can help you up. Pity the man, verse 10, pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. And if you're travelling and it's night and it's cold, well, you can huddle together and keep warm. Verse 11, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Now, this isn't about marriage. In the ancient world, travellers would share a single pile of straw in one of the very not very good inns that were around in those days. There'd be a pile of straw on the floor, and the travellers would all huddle together in this pile of straw, and they'd keep each other warm. Their body heat would keep each other warm. Nothing to do with marriage here, primarily. Although, of course, it does have a secondary application to marriage as well. And if you're travelling, verse 12, you could be attacked. Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A traveller, like the man on the Jericho-Jerusalem road, in those days was liable to be attacked. Well, it was less likely that he would be attacked if there was somebody with him. And even less likely if there were three of them. A cord, verse 12, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. A lovely picture. A cord made out of three strands closely intertwined together. You might be able to break one of them. You might be able to break two. But if the three are intertwined together, It's a cord that's not easily broken. Well, the applications of this passage are legion. As we travel through life, sometimes we can fall. We can fall upon misfortune or hardship. We can fall into sin. And if we do, we need to be helped up. We need somebody to help us up when we fall. There are other people who simply need warm human contact. They need to be warmed up. They need to be encouraged. They may even need an appropriate touch. There's nothing sexual about this at all. They may need an appropriate touch. And there may be other people who are under attack in some way. And they need support. They need people to stand with them. People to speak up for them. People to take up their cause. We need each other, the teacher is saying. There are plenty of applications that I could give to this passage. But I'll leave you to work out the applications for yourself, by and large. But let's take, for instance, Christian work, Christian ministry. Isn't it interesting that Jesus sent out his disciples in twos? It was a principle. He sent them out in twos. Two are better than one. How rarely do we find even the great unmarried Apostle Paul by himself? There's usually Timothy, or Silas, or Luke, or Epaphroditus, or Tychicus close by. He's usually got somebody with him. And can you remember that final passage he wrote at the end of 2 Timothy? 2 Timothy chapter 4. He writes to Timothy, Come and see me. Come and see me quickly. Only Luke is with me. And Demas has forsaken me. Come and see me quickly. Only Luke is with me. Paul, oh, he may have been unmarried. And we don't know the circumstances behind the fact that he was unmarried either. It's actually very unlikely that he was a bachelor. There were virtually no Jewish bachelors. He may have been a widower. His wife may have divorced him when he became a Christian. We don't know. But certainly he was unmarried when he was a Christian apostle. And that doesn't mean to say he didn't have any close relationships. His life was full of close relationships. As was the life of Jesus, of course. Who not only had 12 disciples, but he had three inner. An inner group of three. Peter, James and John. Who he wanted to be with him. Even in the Garden of Gethsemane, he wanted them to be with him. He wanted them to keep awake with him. He was disappointed when they fell asleep. Left him to himself. In agony. Alone. So there are applications, for instance, to Christian work. And take, for instance, an eldership. Isn't it better for a church to be led by a group of elders? Two are better than one. Isn't it great for a church to be led by a team rather than by a one-man minister? Not many churches are actually led by one-man ministers. It's a bit of a myth, actually, the one-man ministry. I don't know any church which is run by one man. You couldn't possibly run a church by yourself. But there are lonely pastors who don't have an eldership with them, to whom they are accountable, to whom he is accountable, who are accountable to each other, who, when one of them needs help, will help each other. When they're cold, when they're discouraged, and it can be discouraging, they can warm each other up. When they're under attack, they can take up one another's cause. It's a great thing to have an eldership. I'm glad that throughout my time in church ministry, I have never been in church ministry without being part of an eldership. And I wouldn't. I wouldn't be one. I wouldn't want to be part of a church ministry. I wouldn't want to be a church leader alone without an eldership. We all need friendship. We all need close relationships. But what do we find? What do we find? Well, when you look at the rest of Ecclesiastes chapter 4, you find that this greedy desire for wealth and status, which the writer condemns throughout Ecclesiastes as completely pointless, because we have to leave it all behind, it also ruins relationship. Look at verse 4. In verse 4 we've got rivalry and competition and envy. I saw that all labour and all achievement spring from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is vapour, a chasing after the wind. Our labour and our achievement spring from our envy of our neighbour. That's what he says. He's talking about the rat race. Instead of helping each other, we compete with each other. We try to outdo each other. We're envious of each other. We want to do better than others. We want to outshine others. Everybody does. We want to keep one step ahead of the Joneses all the time, whoever the Joneses may be. And the result of that is very superficial relationships. We're interested in people to the extent that they can help us get on. And so we network rather than fellowship. And there's a lot of that in the church as well. We network rather than fellowship. We're interested in people who can help us get on, because we're competing with each other all the time, trying to outshine each other. And then other people, of course, are envious of those who seem to have done better than them. They find it impossible to rejoice with those who rejoice. We resent and avoid those who are more successful than us, or who have what we want, or are better off than us, or who we imagine are cleverer than us, or who we think are happier than us. Instead of rejoicing with them, we resent them. We don't want to be with them. I don't want to be part of that group. And it's all due to envy and jealousy. So, envy, rivalry, competition, it plays havoc with our relationships, verse 4. And then verse 8, look at verse 8. There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth. For whom am I toiling, he asked? And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is vapour. A miserable business. We've got the lonely workaholic here. The Howard Hugheses of this world, you know, who's the richest man in the world. He was a billionaire many times over. And he ended his life as a solitary recluse. We've got here the man who finds his whole significance and purpose in his work. He lives to work. He doesn't work to live, he lives to work. The man who will stab anybody in the back to get to the top. The father who hardly knows his children. The mother who puts her career first and isn't there for her children. Do you know why these poor kids are on the streets of London stabbing each other in gangs? Because they don't know who their fathers are. And their mothers are out at work because there isn't a father to provide for them. Their mothers are out at work all day and they're on the streets, and the only place where they can feel accepted is not the family that's broken down. It's the gang. And so they're all striving to be accepted in their gangs. And it's due to the breakdown of relationships. It's due to the breakdown of proper relationships, family relationships, first and foremost. So there in verse 8 we've got this lonely workaholic who he's got everything. He's got to the top, and at the end of it he says, well, for who have I done it for? I've got nobody to share it with. No brother. No son. Son's not interested in me because I wasn't interested in him. I never spent time talking to him and communing with him, so he's not interested in coming around to see me in my old people's home now. I'm sure you've heard that saying that no one on his deathbed has ever said, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. Okay, so there's the lonely workaholic. He is not advocating idleness, verse 5. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. The fool folds his hands and ruins himself. He's the dropout, if you like. I'm dropping out of the rat race. Well, he won't have many friends either, because he's just a sponger. The spongers don't usually have many friends. No, he's not advocating idleness. Verse 6, he is advocating contentment. Better one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. He says, I'd rather have one handful with peace of mind and happiness and a family around me and some good friends and some good conversation. I'd rather have one handful than with that than two handfuls at all cost, even if it means I lose my friends and lose my family. You know, when I was a travelling preacher, before I settled down in a pastorate, I used to travel around preaching, doing one-night stands here, there and everywhere. One of the churches I used to visit was at Frodsham, near Runcorn, on the Wirral. And there was an evangelist who was part of that church there, and he used to invite me to preach. And I always used to go for an evening meal with him and his family before I went to the service to take the evening meeting. And this evangelist, he had nothing. I don't know how much money he had coming in, but he wasn't much. He had no television set. They lived in a little house. And he had five children. And before I was married, and shortly after I was married, when June used to sometimes travel around with me, we used to love going for a meal at this home. We used to love it. They were the happiest little group of people I've ever come across. They had nothing but themselves. The older kids used to help the younger ones with their homework. And the conversation around the mealtime was just scintillating. And we used to love going to this little house. It was one of the happiest homes we've ever been in. Better to have one handful with tranquility than two handfuls with toil and chasing after the wind. And then we've got this funny little passage at the end, verses 13 to 16, which has a few problems with regard to exact accuracy of translation, so we don't want to spend too much time on it. But it seems to me that the basic idea behind verses 13 to 16 is human fickleness and the unreliability of popularity. Even people who have been really, really popular, even people who have been lionized by everybody, there'll come a time when that time of popularity is over. So here's an old king, an old but foolish king. He hasn't always been old, he hasn't always been foolish, but he's old now and he's foolish now. He no longer knows how to take warning. He's hanging on in there at all costs, hanging on to power. A youth, a poor but wise youth, comes along. He may have come from nowhere, verse 14, from prison. He may have been born in poverty. He may have come from nowhere. And verse 15, all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth, the king's successor. He has his honeymoon period. Everybody thinks he's marvellous. He has his honeymoon period. He takes over from the old king. Verse 16, there was no end to all the people who were before them, but those who came later were not pleased with the successor. I reckon this is a passage for Tony Blair. You know, the youthful leader who comes along and everybody thinks, it's going to be different now. New Labour, everything's going to change. And he leaves, of course, with pretty well everybody against him, including members of his own party. And poor old Gordon Brown, he hasn't even had a honeymoon period, has he? I think this passage is basically saying, you know, you can be at the centre of things, you can be the most popular person around, but it won't last for very long. People will soon get fed up of you, and they'll want somebody else. It makes people happier if they can blame their unhappiness on somebody else. It makes them slightly, very slightly happier if they can blame their unhappiness on somebody else. That's what will happen eventually. And it's not just in politics that it happens. It happens in all walks of society. People come and go. Human fickleness. The unreliability of superficial popularity. What we want is not superficial popularity. It's real friendship. Real relationship. That will last a lifetime. There is a friend, says Proverbs, who sticks closer than a brother. And you know, he's not talking about Jesus there. He's not. I know that Jesus is a friend who sticks closer than a brother, but he's actually talking about real friendship. There are friends who stick closer than brothers. Well, okay, that's my exposition of the passage. What can we say about it? Well, scores of things, so I'm going to resist temptation, and I'm going to give very, very few applications. We've got house groups, of course, coming up. The passage to be studied at our next house group meeting will be this passage. There are scores of applications to all this. I've already suggested one application, that is to Christian service, church, ministry, and so on. But let's just leave you with the importance of the local church. The importance of the local church in our increasingly solitary and isolated society. Where do you go to meet people? Where do you go to connect if you're not in a church? Sin destroys our relationship with God, and it destroys our relationship with other people. And Jesus came to restore both those relationships. That's the gospel. And if you're only preaching one of those, you're only preaching half the gospel. If your gospel message is that Jesus came to reconcile us to God, that's very good, but it's only 50% of the gospel. The other 50% of the gospel is that by reconciling us to one God, he reconciles us to each other. The iron filings that are drawn to the magnet, by being drawn to the magnet, are inevitably drawn to each other. And that's what Jesus came to do. He came to heal the fractured relationship between sinners and God by bearing our sins on the cross. And by doing that, he healed the fractured relationships between human beings. And he brings them into one body, the church, and he gives them one spirit. And the church is part of the gospel. It's not an optional extra, it's absolutely essential. To be saved is to be in the church. And part of the witness of the local church to the world will be the quality of our relationships. This should be the major attraction of the Christian church to the world. The quality of our relationship. Fellowship, in other words. I want to also just mention the importance of house groups. You can't get to know everybody equally well as a church grows. House groups, therefore, are at least one place where every church member ought to know that if they fall, there'll be a group of people who will help them up. There'll be a group of people who will warm them up, if necessary. If they're under attack, there's a group of people who will be alongside them. And that's what I'd like our house groups to become. I'd like every church member of Park Street Church to be part of a community like that, where we're mutually helping one another, looking out for one another, ready to warm one another up if necessary, ready to come to one another's defence. And how important other such things like that can be in the local church. What about the out and about group? It's doing a good job. Are you doing a good job, Marjorie? And Joan and others involved in the out and about group. People living alone. Part of a friendly group. Try and draw as many non-Christians into that group as you can. You've already begun to do that. Try and draw more non-Christians who aren't part of this church. Draw it into that group. And then from that group into the church. What about the men? Is it only women who need close relationships? Men don't need relationships. Yes, you do. The teacher was a man, as far as I know. Men need close relationships as well. Hadn't we better start doing something for the blokes? The blokes in our church seem somewhat reluctant to get involved in anything like that. But we ought not to be. We shouldn't be. We were meant for a relationship. And finally, well, there are millions of lonely people out there. What about the isolated elderly? The isolated elderly, regarded as past it. Regarded, sometimes, let's be honest, as a bit of a nuisance. Shouted at in words of one syllable as if they were stupid. Sometimes going days without meaningful contact with any other human being. It's not good. It's bad. So why don't some of us go and do something about it this week? There must be somebody you could go and see. Amen.